Jane Fox for the Thorn and Hatfield Moors Oral History Project. It's the 8th of December 2006, and I'm talking to Henry Chapman and Ben Geary. If I could talk to you first, Henry, could I ask you to just tell me what it is that you do and any particular areas of expertise that you have?
Right, well, my background is really in prehistory, and particularly sort of landscape archaeology and prehistory. And my area of expertise within that as a methodology has been computer modelling, effectively, so modelling landscapes and environmental change within those. But the main focus of my research within those themes has been the archaeology of wetlands. And the reason I look at the archaeology of wetlands is because, firstly, the preservations of volcanic material, wood and those sorts of materials, are so much better in wetlands, but also you can start to reconstruct the environment like, because the actual material in the peat, things like fossil pollen and beetle remains, you can start using those sorts of bits of evidence to start reconstruct what the environment's like. And from my point of view as a landscape archaeologist, you can't just study monuments and settlements within a landscape unless you know what that landscape was like, what it looked like, how it appeared to be, from an economic point of view, but also from how people perceive that landscape.
Well, we think of archaeology as actually just digging up walls and things like that sometimes. How can you model a landscape
and
an economy?
Well, ultimately, digging up walls is fine. You're looking at the actual structures and on that sort of very site-specific basis. But what I find more interesting is the interrelation between different sites and the areas between them and how people actually considered where they lived, you know, where they did certain activities, and particularly why they chose certain locations within the landscape to do certain activities. So if you take a medieval context, people might be living within river valleys, because they're more sheltered. They might be farming on, if they're in the marginal area, they might be farming the south-facing slopes because, obvious reason, you get more sunlight. Those sorts of elements, on a crude level, are why people live in certain areas and do certain activities in certain areas. From a prehistoric perspective, all these things are true. But also you get, in terms of ceremonial landscape as well, and the ritual landscape, where people are choosing certain areas for certain activities for a variety of different reasons, and it's those elements which become more important, and you can't study those from just looking at the site itself. Does that answer anything you just
vaguely? Yes, absolutely. Now we're in Birmingham University.
Yep.
What's your role here?
I work within the Hewlett-Packard Visualisation and Spatial Technology Centre, which I'm co-director of that within Birmingham, and the focus of that's really is one part of a variety of groups within the university studying different types of archaeology, but all loosely looking really at landscapes. You know, the focus really in Birmingham is on archaeological landscapes. So my section is looking at the technological applications, so really an extension of my experience in computer modelling of landscapes and trying to reconstruct them, but it also extends out into all sorts of new methods of surveying, laser scanning, use of GPS, all sorts of other sorts of geophysical equipment. Those sort of techniques, but also modelling that data in computers. So that's my section, but I liaise very closely with, say, Ben's group, which is looking at the environmental, they're looking at environmental archaeology. And there's such an overlap because we're all studying landscape, that it's quite a nice place to be because you can start. Although my focus is one thing, I need to liaise with other people in order to get the full picture of landscape. You can't do it on your own.
And how did you come to be here?
Really through knowing Vince Gaffney, who's a professor here. Who does similar sorts of things that I do in terms of the computer modelling. And the centre here has some of the, sort of internationally really, some of the best facilities available, certainly within archaeology. So it's just a great place to be for the types of work that I do. And having such a strong landscape archaeology sort of focus, then it's, you know, it's a perfect place for me.
And can you give me some idea of the work that you have done in the past? And not specifically, you know, connected with Thorn and Hatfield Moors, but just in general terms.
Well, I used to work for Hull University, and I was working for a project called the Humber Wetlands Project, which was looking really at all the lowlands around the Humber. Before that, I was working for the Royal Commission on Historic Monuments as a landscape investigator. So sort of my landscape background sort of started then. But working within the wetlands in Hull for 10 years or so, I was working on numerous sites around that landscape, places like Sutton Common, looking at Thorn and Hatfield Moors, just sites dotted around the whole area, as part of this wider landscape project, which finished around about 2000. But then from that, I've been sort of working, working reasonably focused actually within that northeast region, but also sort of expanding to other areas as well. So that's sort of been home, if you like, as from a research point of view. Because it's wetlands, you know, it has all the elements which are interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Ben, and here he is, we have to know. Could I ask you the same questions? Could you give me some idea or description of what it is that you do and your particular area of expertise?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm probably call myself an environmental archaeologist. My main area of research is in environmental change and past environments. I guess my sort of special interest, which overlaps with Henry, is the role of people in those landscapes. So how landscapes change over time, the role of humans within those processes of change, and indeed how those processes of change may, you know, affect human society. So sort of cultural environmental overlap, I suppose. That's sort of my main area of research.
And what form does that take?
I mainly work with fossil pollen, so pollen is preserved in peat bogs, such as, of course, Lone Hatfield Moors, but other contexts as well. I sort of work all over, really. Anywhere there's peat is a good place for environmental archaeology.
And how does that link in with Nikki Whitehouse's work?
Nikki mainly works, as you know, on subfossil insect remains. I work on subfossil pollen remains, so recently we've been collaborating on deposits from Thorn Hatfield Moors, amongst other places, where she will look at the insect record and I'll work on the pollen record, and the two will complement each other in various ways.
Okay. Can you give me a little bit of background as to how you arrived at the point that you're at today?
Sure, yeah. Rather like Henry, I worked as part of the Humber Wetlands Project in Hull, which sort of, I suppose, dates the beginning of our sort of research collaboration. Previous to that, I'd done a PhD down in Plymouth. And after that, I'd worked for a couple of years in Exeter, again working sort of environmental archaeology of wetland landscapes, which again was my sort of feed into the Humber Wetlands Project and ultimately to the work we're involved with nowadays.
Mm. Can I ask you a little bit about the process in general terms of how you obtain the information that you want and what that tells us?
Sure. You obtain the information by taking the samples, just like any other form of environmental archaeology. You need to have the deposits before you can do anything with them. Again, which is why landscapes such as Thorn Hatfield are so good, because there's so much peat. So any sort of project begins with obviously identifying deposits that have potential, because obviously there's no deposits, and you can't do the work, clearly. So landscapes like Thorn Hatfield, we have lots of peat and a lot of potential. Take the samples in the field, you take it back to the lab, and then for pollen, in this case, we extract the pollen grains using basically a chemical process in a laboratory, concentrate the pollen onto a microscope slide, then you count the pollen using a microscope. So that's sort of that's how it very briefly how that process works. You end up with a pollen diagram, and then of course you have to worry about things like radiocarbon dating, how you date your peat accumulation, and of course through that how you date your pollen record. And then, of course, how you start linking the whole thing together with landscape changes and with people and with archaeology and so forth.
So if you have, for example, a wall, a cut through the peat that goes right down to
mm-hmm.
base, underneath, whatever
yeah.
it is at the bottom, how would you extract the pollen from that for it to be useful for any purpose?
Well, say we just literally take a sequence of peat and disturb sequence through the peat, whether that's using a coring device, or something like Thorn and Hatfield, where we've got ditch sections, we take tins of sediment basically, and you take those away to the lab basically, and then you subsample that in the lab, and as I say, after that, that's, you know, you put those samples through the pollen preparation process, as it's known, basically. So that's how it works. Any of the samples, of course, we can take from those sections as well, usually samples for radiocarbon dating, or if I'm working with someone like Nicky, of course, we will sample from the same section, so you can put the two records together basically.
So you would sample in sections which would be going through time?
Yes, basically, yes. You go down through the peat, you go backwards in time. That is the process. Peat accumulates over time scales, sometimes stretching back to, you know, the end of the last ice age. Thorn and Hatfield Moors, of course, the chronology is not quite that long, but we're still talking, you know, 5,000 years maybe of accumulated sediment, and of course that means 5,000 years of accumulated environmental history in the form of pollen and beetles.
So you get a pollen record.
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell us?
Well, in a very simple sense, it tells us how the proportions of pollen grains have changed over time, and by inference, of course, that shows us how vegetation's changed over time and the role of processes such as climate change, and of course human impact on that vegetation. That's the basic premise of pollen analysis.
Excellent, thank you. You both talked about being involved in the Humber Wetlands project. Can I ask you, Henry, to tell me something about that?
The Humber Wetlands project was the fourth of a series of English Heritage funded projects, which were a response to the realisation that wetlands were important for archaeology because of preservation. Not just preservation of archaeological remains, but also the environmental remains which we're talking about. So the first had been the Somerset Levels, the work of people like John Coles. Then there'd been the Fenlands as well, people like Francis Pryor working there.
What do you mean by the Fenlands?
The Fenlands is really the whole area around Peterborough, around the coast, and it's a huge, huge landscape. And there's the northwest as well. Bob Middleton run that one, which was again like a sort of Cheshire bogs. And there, it's a slightly different sort of wetland because it's more split up around that landscape rather than big, like the Humberhead Levels, which is a huge, vast area of vast wetland. And the fourth one had been the Humberhead Levels, which was run by Robert Mantenor, who's now at Exeter University. And the focus of it really was to survey the whole landscape, to try and get an idea of, if you imagine these areas are large, can be quite blank in terms of the traditional record offices, because the processes of that create wetlands mean that our normal ways of trying to find archaeology don't always work. So for example, things like aerial photography, where you're looking for crop marks, which is basically when you get a difference in the height and growth regimes of different crops, depending on what's underneath them. That sort of process relies on having well-drained soils, so well-drained geology, so that the crop growing over, say, a ditch would have more moisture than the surrounding area, so the crop grows better. Within wetlands, the landscape is by nature not very well-drained, so you don't tend to get the formation of that sort of evidence. And also you get, through rivers going into flood, you actually get the deposition of silts or alluvium actually over the top of sites. So quite often you get buried archaeology, which you can't see using some traditional methods. Even things like geophysics don't work that well generally within wetlands. So the projects were all really aimed at trying to get a handle on what these landscapes meant, both in terms of, by the time of the Humber Wetlands project, it was a collaboration between the environmental side and the archaeological side. So we were walking plough fields trying to find flint, pottery, those sorts of things which don't always show up elsewhere unless you're actually on the ground looking for them. Combining that sort of distribution of sites to what we understood about the environment at the right period, and then sort of bringing all that together, excavating some sites. It was right across the landscape. We looked at the Humberhead Levels, the Vale of York, the Ancombe Valley, the Trent, the Linkshire Marsh, the Hull Valley, Holderness, the whole region around that area. So year by year, we covered different areas. So it's a huge landscape project, just trying to get a handle on the potential for evidence in that region.
Do you want to add anything, Ben?
No, I don't think so. I think part my sort of role within that was looking at the peat sequences, the sediment sequences in the river valleys, and dating the accumulation of sediment, and looking at the record, the pollen record, to see what the potential for further work was really, and that was sort of part of the integrated part of the project. And of course, as part of that dating, the accumulation of these sequences, and as Henry's alluded to, the fact that if you have peat forming across a landscape, you may have archaeology under that peat as well. So it's also thinking about buried land surfaces that have been buried by processes of peat development or deposition of alluvium from rivers, and these deposits which can mask entire past landscapes, if you like, which is what we see at Hatfield Moors as well, of course.
We think of Thorn and Hatfield Moors because that's what we're looking at for this project. How do they sit within the Humberhead Levels landscape?
They're kind of the focus, they're within the sort of southwestern portion of the area which we were defining as the Humber Wetlands, but really that sort of western part, or west of the Wolds, is going sort of from, say, Gainsborough all the way up to Barth York. It's a huge area, and obviously Thorn Hatfield Moors sort of in the southern section of that. But the actual the boundaries of Thorn Hatfield Moors now, as they are as National Nature Reserves and so on, is quite artificial because of processes such as artificial warping, actually bringing sediment onto the fields, onto the peat, so that you can farm these areas. What's happened is the actual area of the past peatlands has been shrunk hugely. And in many ways, we don't really know how big it really was, because the mapping evidence comes from a time when a lot of this imp- So Thornton Happy Moors are a huge landscape, and interestingly, when you look at the sort of past in sort of antiquarians who have written about those landscapes, quite often they're quite I think it's quite telling that they're not very specific about what Thornton Hatfield Moors are. That they use phrases such as the Hatfield Chase, which now is an area you can see on the Ordnance Survey map, but they'll have it to include Thornton Hatfield Moors, and somebody else use a different term, and you get this real impression from that literature that the whole landscape is just one vast wetland used in different ways for hunting or for pea cutting or so on. But that whole area up until reasonably recently was quite ill-defined. You know, so Thornton Hatfield Moors as they are now is quite a modern concept, really.
I talked with Nikki this morning about how the moors themselves bear a lot of similarities with continental bogs, more than with bogs elsewhere in the UK. Just looking at the pollen in that, is there evidence within that to support that?
Not directly. I think when Nikki talks about them being more continental bogs, she's referring more to the bogs as an ecosystem, if you follow me. Our main area of interest when we're looking at pollen records from bogs is generally the vegetation that's growing around the bogs, so the drylands, if you like. So that's the main point of looking at pollen records from those sites. Which is not to say, of course, you don't also have pollen from plants growing on the bogs as well. But as I say, generally the sort of concept of what Nick is referring to is more to do with the actual bog ecosystem, which is, say, from a biological point of view, I'm more interested generally in what's going on around the bogs. So that's not so much something you'd sort of comment on too much from a pollen point of view, I suppose.
Are you able to say when the bogs started to, Thornton Hatfield Moors started to form, and what might have been there before?
I think this is a real sort of team question, really. There's different ways of actually approaching that question. Although that sounds like quite a straightforward question, it's really not. In one way, the pre-peat landscape was very much like the rest of the Humhead levels was, I suspect. So you'd have had, in certain areas, you've got rivers running, certainly around Hatfield Moors. There's also indications of possible rivers and that sort of feature running across Thorn as well. So you'd have had the normal sort of pattern of hunter-gatherers probably occupying areas adjacent to rivers, which seems to be the pattern. Probably quite a similar landscape right across, but when we start getting peat forming on Thornton Hatfield Moors, which is different in each case because the actual geology is very different on Hatfield compared to Thorn. So Hatfield is very sandy, whereas Thorn is more of a clay sort of subsurface, sub-peat surface. The actual development of peat, it comes down to one of these problems of definition of what peat is, in a way, because normally when we talk about bogs or raised mires, we're referring to what's known as the ombrotrophic peat, so the moss peat, sphagnum sort of peat. And that is a later phase of what's becoming a wetting up landscape. And what we're finding is for different areas, and this was such a complex question, different areas of both Thorn and Hatfield Moors seem to develop this initial phase of wetting at different times, whereas the actual ombrotrophy, this raised mire, seems to be slightly later, and I would say sort of probably more as a single phase. You know more about this than me.
As Henry says, Hatfield Moors is basically, underneath Hatfield Moors you have sands, cover sands, which are pretty much sort of deposits at the end of the last ice age, so very sandy soils. Thorn Moors is clay, basically, from Lake Humber, which is a pre-Holocene, at the end of the last ice age. You get a big lake in that part of the world and deposits this clay subsurface. So, yes, you get probably quite different vegetation growing underneath, even though they both end up as mires, which is why I refer to them as a pair, as Thorn Hatfield Moors. Certainly in the very, very early parts of the Holocene, they would probably look quite different. And it's only that end point is reached thousands of years later. So, for example, on Hatfield, pre-peat landscape is probably dominated by pine trees, for example, and heather, quite sort of open vegetation compared to Thorn, where you've got heavier soil, so you've probably got more of a sort of typical Humberhead levels, woodland with oak and birch and trees, and older trees and so forth. So they both follow slightly different pathways to the same end point, which is of course is acid raise Maya, basically.
I might be going beyond what you can actually answer, but when we're talking about Lake Humber and we're talking about the formation of the silts on Thornmoor and the sand dunes on Hatfield Chase, are we talking, first of all, with Lake Humber, we're talking about an open piece of open water, are we?
Yes, well, there's a general debate about whether Lake Humber is one continuous body of water or lots of sort of smaller bodies of water. That's probably more of a question for a geologist than for ourselves to answer. But certainly you see the Lake Humber clays all over that part of the Humber level. It's a very distinctive deposit which lies under a lot of the lot of the later deposits in the river valleys as well as in the Thorn Moors.
And are they at the same time? So I'm trying to get an image of what it might look like. We've got a piece of standing water and like a beach, basically.
There are beach-like deposits. I think certainly some of the work that Mark Bateman in Sheffield has done, he's looking at some of the sort of deposits from the edge, from the very edge of Lake Humber. But again, this remains a whole area of research in itself, if you like. And we tend to be, it's not something we work on, because it's some thousands of years before the peatlands certainly start forming, and say even before the start of the Holocene. So again, that's more of a question for a geologist, really.
Yeah. What I'm trying to establish in mind is whether are we looking at the very edge of Lake Humber when we're looking at the difference between Thorn and Hatfield?
That's a tricky one. Why? Because Thorn is clay, so you're saying that's Lake Humber, whereas Hatfield is sand. I think it's probably, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but what I see is you've got Lake Humber right across, but you're getting a reworking of those sediments very, very early, straight after the glacial period. So what's happening is this is one story. If you've got Lake Humber, which is arguably or not a standing body of water, eventually as the ice sheets are retreating, this water breaks through the Humber Gap, so basically where the River Humber is, an estuary is, and the water comes off the land. It comes off very, very rapidly. And at that time, you've got a reasonably treeless landscape, not much vegetation to stabilise things. So what's happening is sort of tundra, I suppose, at that point. You've got very deeply incised rivers. Because sea level's so low, the water's trying to get off the land as quick as it can. Because all the seawater's held up in the ice, because the ice sheets are still there. So the water's trying to get off the land, and it's cutting very, very deep channels. So when we come to, say, the Mesolithic landscape, anything else, 6,000 BC, something like that, you've got these very, very deep V sort of profile rivers, which are a function of this water coming off the land. But the whole land, that's just one aspect of that early landscape. It's a huge amount of reworking. This point where the Lurs on the old Hungarian plain, large chunks of Europe are completely altered. Because, as far as I see it, and I'm an archaeologist, but it's because there's not the vegetation to hold to stabilise landscapes, and so it's a vicious open climate with huge environmental change. So, I think what's happened with places like Hatfield, Hatfield's slightly more complicated than just being sand. It's also a ridge of glacial moraine as well, running sort of through that landscape, creating central island, and you've got sands blowing up to that and creating this sort of sandy area. So it's all just of reworking and changing to the landscape. So locally over the Humber levels you get huge changes. If you go to Sutton Common, for example, we've got one of these rivers cutting straight through the middle of this Iron Age site, well predating the Iron Age site, and you've got the formation of little islands and things which become occupied in the Iron Age. It's all that reworking at that very early phase which is creating what is Thorn and what is Hatfield Moors, at least pre-peat. Would you concur, Dr. Geary?
Yes, I mean all these processes are happening. Well, by the time we moved into the Holocene, so 10,000 years ago, the climate's improved and vegetation's colonising everywhere anyway at that point. So you get different vegetation, as I say, on Thorn and Hatfield Moors anyway. So in terms of, Lake Humber's long gone by then. That's the late Devonian thing.
Mm. And followed by trees?
Yeah.
The trees you described?
Yeah, the sequence of vegetation development is the same pretty much for the region as it is for the rest of England, where you get the trees arriving fairly rapidly after around 9,000 years BP. So are we switching between BC and BP dates, which is to confuse the issue. So yeah, when you get the trees arriving in quite a well-ordered succession, really. So really, by 7,000-ish years before present, we're talking about a substantially closed woodland environment over all of the Humboldt levels, really.
And at what point in theory would you expect humans to live in that environment?
They're coming from the very early phases. From the beginning of the Holocene, we've got evidence of people. The very, very early Mesolithic is quite difficult to see in many places. But what's happened, of course, is that while sea level's been really low, Britain, as it is as an island now, has been connected to the continental mainland by what's been referred to in the past as land bridges. Not really, it's more because sea level's so low, the seabed was exposed. It was a dry land, it was a proper landscape with woodlands and rivers and everything else. It's referred to commonly as Doggerland, probably some work by Bryony Coles a few years back. But people have been occupying that area. That was just another landscape rather than being a bridge. It was actually where people were living. And it just sort of has there's each time, going way back in time, each time there's been an ice age or ice advance, ice has come down, people, animals have migrated south into other parts. And then as the ice has retreated back, plants, animals, people have retreated back forwards. So there's all been this ongoing sort of wave of movement. And really, at the end of the last ice age, after the Devensian, people were occupying and were able to access and were already living in Britain at that time anyway. So the actual movement of people was not, we had people here by the early Mesolithic.
Which is what?
Around about, I suppose, probably 10,000 BC, something like that.
BC?
Mm-hmm. Long time ago.
Okay. And do we have any actual concrete evidence for that?
We
in
do.
In the Humboldt levels?
In the Humboldt levels, it's much of the evidence comes from flints, and this is going to come back to the whole reason why wetlands are so important. What happens is the people were, the very earliest part of the Holocene, we keep on finding these little sites on the edges of where the rivers have been, where you've got these deeply incised rivers taking the water off the land, and you get these little areas where people have been sat working tools, making tools, so they're napping the flint, they're breaking it down to make little, but these are little sort of fragments which they're called microliths, which sort of stick together and you can make arrows and so on, arrowheads. So you find these areas of really the rubbish after they've been making the tools. So they normally take the tool away with them, occasionally you find those, but it's normally the rubbish left over. So you find out where they've been making the little tools on the sides of the rivers particularly. And that's your evidence for the Mesolithic, the majority of our understanding of Mesolithic, particularly the early phases. And the dating of this really comes down to differences in ways of working the flint. Now, for a very long period, that's the majority of the evidence is purely the actual flint itself. Now, occasionally you get sites which have other sorts of evidence which you can start dating using things like radiocarbon. But and Feller Pickering's very good for this, getting this up slightly later on. But in each of these cases, really, you're relying to some extent, certainly for that part of the world, on the creation of wetlands. So the earlier you can get formation of peat, which is normally a result of sea level rising and rivers changing their nature and starting creating floodplains. So until that sort of happens, you're not getting the sort of sediments which you can start dating easily to really tie this stuff down. So for large periods in the Mesolithic, certainly, the evidence is dominated mostly by just these stone remains. So occasionally you sort of join dots between sites which are more dispersed, trying to understand that.